Ba'athist Iraq and policing the Persian Gulf. Greater ideological and territorial challenges were found closer to home in neighbouring Iraq. These started with the 1958 Iraqi Revolution and continued for most of the volatile decade with military coups and political instability following the fall of the Hashemite dynasty. After the 1967 coup that brought to power the Ba'ath Party, Party of Resurrection, the two countries engaged in border disputes almost continuously, especially over the shared waterway Shatt al-Arab, or Arvand Rud, as the Iranians began to call it, remembering its historical Persian name. Intermittent frontier skirmishes along the Zagros mountain range, stretching from Khuzestan to Kurdistan, propaganda wars over radio waves and in the press, and retaliatory actions further troubled Iraq's relations with Iran. The Shi'i population in southern Iraq and the Iraqi Kurds in the north badly suffered at the hands of the Ba'athist regime, which primarily drew support from the Sunni Arab population. For the most part, before the 1990s, the West turned a blind eye to Ba'athist atrocities, primarily because of the vast Iraqi oil exports, which rivaled Iranian production, but also the lucrative military and economic contracts that Western firms had begun to secure in Iraq. By 1971, with the rapid rise to power of Saddam Hussein, 1937 to 2006, and his menacing grip over Iraqi state and society, confrontations with Iran took a turn for the worse. The death in 1970 of Nasser, defeated and demoralized, offered President Saddam Hussein an opportunity to emerge as the new strongman of the Arab world. He championed the Palestinian cause, challenged conservative Arab regimes, and offered a bold match to the Shah of Iran, at least for those on the international stage who were loath to see the Shah as the unrivaled master of the Persian Gulf. Relying on Iraq's oil revenues, which multiplied after the 1973 oil crisis, and his pan-Arab politics, Saddam seemed to have been successful at tilting the balance in the historic rivalry between Cairo and Baghdad in favour of the latter, especially after President Anwar al-Sadat's 1975 expulsion of Soviet military advisers and his overtures of peace to Israel. The threat of Saddam's Iraq in turn persuaded the Shah to move closer to the United States and purchase more arms for his sizable arsenal, whereas Iraq acquired almost client status with the Soviet Union, becoming its most important Arab ally after signing a treaty of friendship and cooperation in 1975. Ba'athist hostility toward Iran was rooted in historical tensions that frequently flared up along the country's common border. It was based on the assumption that since ancient times, Iran had always entertained territorial ambitions over Iraq. The Sasanian Empire, named after a dynasty that originated in the Iranian plateau, had expanded its domains to Mesopotamia, where its capital, Ctesiphon, was located on the banks of the Tigris River. As breadbasket for an expansionist empire, Sasanian Mesopotamia was an ethno-cultural and religious melting pot whose indelible mark survived for centuries, even beyond the Islamic High Caliphate. As the birthplace of Shi'ism, and home to the holiest Shi'i shrines and centres for Shi'i learning, it had additional appeal to Shi'i Iran. It was not mere coincidence that twice under the Safavids, Baghdad was conquered by Shi'i Iran, and afterward in the 18th and 19th centuries, Iran made deep sorties into the Iraqi territory. The border dispute between powers on two sides of the Zagros dated back centuries, perhaps one of the oldest in the history of the world. Iran's western border was the oldest natural boundary, perhaps the only one, in the whole of the Middle East, dividing the Mesopotamian lowlands from the Iranian plateau. In the highlands of Kurdistan, the population on both sides of the border maintained close cultural, tribal, and linguistic ties and preserved a degree of autonomy. With the rise of Turkish, Arab, and Iranian nationalisms, the Kurds also developed their own nationalist identity, and since World War I, intermittently dreamed of a united Kurdistan. Ethnic and linguistic differences with the Kurds of Turkey, moreover, made unification more elusive, if not untenable. Yet the Kurds on the Iranian side were somewhat more integrated, in part because of their ethno-linguistic affinity with Iran. There were strong ethno-cultural underpinnings to the frontier tensions with Arabic Sunni Iraq, however. The young country of Iraq, charged with a sense of Arab pride and laying claim to the legacy of the Abbasid Caliphate of Baghdad, as well as the ancient Babylonian civilization and the Assyrian Empire, had developed a brand of national identity under the Ba'athist regime that was existentially antagonistic to the realities of its own diverse population. It was at odds with its own Arab neighbours as well, let alone non-Arab Iran. The national building project of the British Mandate in the post-World War I era succeeded only nominally in integrating the ethnically and geographically diverse populations into a nation of shared values and shared destiny. Even less than Turkish and Iranian nationalism, Ba'athist Arabism hardly ever tried in earnest to integrate or tolerate other identities within its borders. The autonomy-seeking movement of Iraqi Kurdistan was a source of deep anxiety to the Baghdad government and frequently the victim of its atrocities. It also was a source of hostility vis-à-vis Iran. Under the leadership of Mullah Mustafa Barzani, 1903-1979, a veteran of the earlier short-lived Mahabad Republic of 1945-1946, the Iraqi Kurds from the late 1950s intermittently fought against Baghdad and negotiated with it in a bitter struggle for autonomy. With the hardening of the Ba'athist positions under Saddam Hussein, in 1974, a major Kurdish revolt brought the Iraqi government head-to-head with the Iranians, who had supplied arms and provisions to the Kurds over the years, and later sheltered as many as 200,000 refugees and Peshmerga guerrilla fighters in border camps and in the Iranian interior. The Iranian support for the Kurdish revolt was primarily political. Over the years, Pahlavi Iran had adamantly resisted similar autonomy-seeking aspirations, even cultural ones, among its own Kurds. The Shah's action was part of a broader pattern of retaliation against the Iraqi regime that, at least since 1968, had dampened relations between the two countries. Saddam's hostile move against its Shi'i population, especially against a community of Iranian descent who had long resided in the Shi'i holy cities of Iraq as early as the 13th century. Between 1968 and 1974, the Iraqi government drove out more than 60,000 people of Iranian descent and dumped them on the Iranian side of the border. The arrival of these returnees injured Iranian sentiments and brought the conflict with Iraq to a boil. Iran had maintained a religious, political, and cultural presence in the Iraqi south for at least five centuries. At least since the 13th century Ilkhanid period, Iran had laid a moral claim over the Shi'i shrines of Karbala and Najaf, and drew on the loyalties of the Iraqi Shi'is in the south. Nearly all the Shi'i shrines and other religious sites had been built, restored, and funded by Persian rulers and dignitaries, and there were extensive pious endowments devoted to the upkeep of these shrines. The steady stream of Iranian pilgrims was a major contributor to the Iraqi economy of the south, and most religious seminaries were populated by Iranian teachers and students, with a vast network of custodians and other beneficiaries of the Mojtahed's distribution of arms and other religious funds. Many of the cemeteries of Najaf and Karbala, and whatever space was left in and around the Shi'i shrines in these cities, were filled with bodies of pious Iranians who were brought to southern Iraq as late as the 20th century. Vast sums of arms and other religious dues were also donated by the Iranian faithful to the coffers of the Shi'i Marjas in Najaf. Saddam's regime despised the Iranian Shi'i connection and found it against its project of Arab homogenization. Typical of any dictatorial regime with a constructed identity, Saddam determined to wipe out the Persian malady. The arrival of the Kurdish refugees and the Shi'i returnees coincided with heightened border clashes, which had taken place on and off along the common border since 1968. These were in part because of demarcation disputes that stemmed from numerous border commissions since the middle of the 19th century. Iran was dissatisfied with the 1937 Saadabad non-aggression treaty involving Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Afghanistan, concluded under the aegis of the British. The treaty assigned to landlocked Iraq full control of the Shatt al-Arab waterway, so as to offer a reliable outlet for its oil exports and access to the open seas via the port of Basra. Insisting on its historic rights, however, in 1969, Iran declared the treaty null and void on the grounds that it was a British colonial legacy that deprived Iran's free shipping along the waterway to the Persian Gulf. Access to the port of Khorramshahr, Iran's most important commercial entrepot, and further south to Abadan, the site of Iran's most extensive refinery, was at stake. What Iran demanded was a shared control of the waterway and full shipping rights along its maiden baseline. From the Iraqi perspective, this was a breach of its sovereignty. From the Iranian perspective, it was a restoration of its territorial rights under international law. The Ba'athist narrative embraced by the Iraqis viewed the Iranian claim as a repeat of the old Persian hegemony and an ominous sign of the Shah's growing ambitions. Iraq's repeated sorties against Iranian border guards were disruptive, though not wholly effective. By 1974, the Ba'athist regime, clearly on the defensive, was anxious to reach some face-saving settlement with Iran. Mindful of internal dissent among the Kurds in the north and the Shi'is in the south, as well as in his own Ba'athist ranks, Saddam became uncharacteristically conciliatory toward his neighbors. Following a meeting between the Shah and Saddam, arranged by the Algerian president in March 1975, during the annual meeting of OPEC leaders in Algiers, the two sides signed a preliminary agreement addressing three crucial issues in dispute. The Algiers Accord, as it came to be known, served as the basis for bilateral treaties later that year, calling for the delineation of common boundaries based on the 1913 Constantinople Protocol, delimitation of the water boundaries of Shatt al-Arab, Arvand Rud, based on the Talveig Line, and joint monitoring of the boundaries to guarantee the security of both sides. The remarkable concessions ceded by Saddam were a clear victory for the Shah in his long and acrimonious dealings with Iraq, and a new zenith in his Persian Gulf policy. Yet the concessions came at a dear cost to the Kurdish rebels, who, having heavily relied on Iranian support against Baghdad, viewed the agreement as a betrayal of their cause. Mustafa Barzani, who had taken refuge in Iran and, as a guest of the Iranian government, was housed, along with his top commanders, outside Tehran, remained there until his death in 1979. Ironically, in 1946, he was driven out of Mahabad by the Iranian government and treated ever after as a persona non grata. Most refugees returned to Iraqi Kurdistan, having been assured by Baghdad of amnesty and guaranteed safe passage. Unaware of the tragic fate that awaited them, and the hundreds of thousands of their fellow Kurdish citizens in the towns and villages of Kurdistan, they succumbed to the abrupt end to the Iran-Iraq conflict, at least for the time being. The successful settlement of the conflict with Iraq, though ephemeral, boosted Iran's involvement in the Persian Gulf beyond anything it had experienced, at least since the heyday of Shah Abbas I in the early 17th century. Already the occupation in November 1971 of three small and largely uninhabited but strategically important islands in the middle of the Persian Gulf and in the wake of British withdrawal raised angry protests from the newly established United Arab Emirates and other neighbours. The Arab world viewed the annexation as a breach of UAE sovereignty, and Iran considered the occupation merely the reassertion of its inalienable territorial rights. Coming in the wake of Bahrain's independence, which was declared after Iran under British pressure, gave up its historical claims to the island, Iranian annexation of the three islands seemed almost inevitable. As early as Sasanian times, Iran claimed sovereignty over Bahrain and its environs, which continued intermittently through the Islamic medieval period. In the early Safavid era, Ismail's ambition to recapture the island from a local Arab sheikhdom was frustrated by the arrival of the Portuguese, who in 1521 established their strategic base at the head of the Persian Gulf. It was another 70 years before Shah Abbas I could expel the Portuguese in 1602 and establish Shi'i rule on the island as part of its supremacy over the Persian Gulf shores, in competition with Ottoman control of Basra at the head of the Gulf. Persian suzerainty, often through local dynasties, lasted for two centuries. Only British naval supremacy over the Persian Gulf from the beginning of the 19th century, along with its long-standing colonial policy that often backed regional enclaves vis-à-vis the Iranian centre, allowed the sheikhs of Al-Khalifa, a minor clan from Kuwait, to thrive in Bahrain under the British colonial gaze. Repeated protests by the emasculated Qajar state throughout the 19th century were dismissed. As an important naval base and hub of local trade, Bahrain, like nearby Qatar and Kuwait, was a British protectorate conforming to the so-called Trucial States. It was important not only for its bustling trade conducted by a cosmopolitan trade community, but also for combating piracy at the head of the Persian Gulf and along its southern coasts, as well as deterring the Omani and Wahhabi threats. Oil exploration from the 1930s only offered further incentives for continued British colonial protection. Already in 1970, the United Nations had held a plebiscite that established the Bahraini desire for independence. The eventual settling of the Bahrain question obliged Iran to renounce its claim of sovereignty over the island. A fair amount of nationalist uproar at home for what was viewed as bowing to British pressure persuaded the Shah to remain adamant about the Iranian claim to the three islands in the middle of the Persian Gulf, despite vehement objections by UAE members and other Arab states. Iran's geopolitical ambitions beyond the Persian Gulf and into the Arabian Sea and Gulf of Oman and Indian Ocean further agitated radical Arab regimes from Libya to South Yemen. Beginning in 1973, Iranian military involvement on behalf of the Sultanate of Oman in a war waged against the Popular Front for the Liberation of the Occupied Arabian Gulf, a communist South Yemen-backed guerrilla movement in the Thafar region, on the eastern coast of the Arabian Peninsula, revealed the Shah's anxiety over communist penetration of the region. Inheriting a conflict from British times, a small battalion of Iranian special forces, backed by the Iranian Air Force, fought a costly war with the Omani troops. The rebellion was crushed by 1975. Border disputes with Iraq, the war of words with Nasser, annexation of the Three Islands, and the Thafar intervention did not seriously dent the Shah's overall success in his regional policy throughout the 1960s and early 1970s. Aiming for friendship with moderate Arab regimes, he befriended King Hussein of Jordan, reigned 1952 to 1999, who often was a recipient of the Shah's largesse and moral support against the king's many enemies. Anwar al-Sadat, 1918 to 1981, whom the Shah fully backed and advised throughout the Egyptian-Israeli peace process, was another important friend. Both the Lebanese Shi'i and the Maronite leaders were his tactical allies, including Musa Sadr, 1928-1978, the Iranian-born leader of the Shi'i Amal movement in Lebanon. On Iran's eastern borders, Pakistan, under Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, 1928-1979, relied heavily on Iran's economic aid, moral support, and diplomatic backing, as did Mohammad Davood Khan, 1909-1978, the first president of Afghanistan, after he deposed Mohammad Zahir Shah, reigned 1933-1973, in a bloodless coup in 1973. Davood benefited from Iranian aid to counter the growing Soviet influence in his country, as did the deposed Mohammad Zahir in exile. Davood also appealed to Iran to settle border disputes with Pakistan, a reflection of the Shah's rising regional stance. By the mid-1970s, the Shah had been able to carve out a strategic niche in the midst of a superpower divide on which the stability of the Persian Gulf and neighboring countries depended. Contrary to the conventional narrative articulated by his domestic and Western critics, and despite his many blind spots, the Shah came to be seen by the two superpowers and by European powers as an experienced statesman and a crucial ally who built up a popular base at home, carried out domestic reforms, averted conservative opposition, thwarted his radical Arab neighbors, and worked toward stability and peace in the region. From the Shah's perspective, his compliance with US foreign policy objectives not only was inevitable, given his country's perilous geopolitics, but also was beneficial to Iran's stability and prosperity. Though always anxious to prove his loyalty to the West, he was skillful in appeasing his Soviet neighbor too, often to his advantage. It could be argued that the Shah's latter years were the most stable in Iran's foreign policy, considering Iran's fateful geopolitics since the turn of the 19th century. In retrospect, the Shah's stabilizing effect may be gauged by the aftershocks that the region witnessed after the collapse of the Pahlavi order and the revolution of 1979. Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, destabilization of Pakistani politics, the rise of Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athists as a regional menace, the emergence of Saudi Arabia as a petroleum empire, and subsequent Wahhabi Salafi militancy. Evolving image of the United States. By the mid-1970s, repression at home and shortfalls in economic spheres cast a long shadow over the Pahlavi state, beyond even the reality, an image further blemished by perceptions of compliance with Western interests. The United States, in particular, came to be seen by the Iranian public, even beyond a cluster of liberal and leftist trends and clerical dissidents, as a selfish superpower that exploited Iran's natural resources, kept the Shah in power, and perpetuated repression. The burgeoning anti-Americanism of the 1940s and 1950s was later internalized by a wide spectrum of Iranian dissenters. The image of the United States as a hegemonic superpower was further blemished during the Vietnam War, which received extensive coverage in the Iranian press. That the massive U.S. armed forces were relentlessly carpet-bombing and dropping napalm and Agent Orange on the Viet Cong struck average Iranians, as average people elsewhere around the world, as brutal and unfair. Sympathy for the suffering Vietnamese often meant hatred for the Yankee aggressor. Before President Jimmy Carter's human rights policy in 1977 raised implicit concerns over the Iranian situation, U.S. administrations had barely made any visible public criticism of the Shah's conduct, nor did any major voice within the U.S. intelligence community, to the extent that is known, or other circles close to Washington, seriously assess the consequences of his arbitrary rule. His stronghold over Iranian society was taken for granted by American statesmen, with a mix of condescension and forced respectability. It was not unlike 19th-century colonial administrators' honoring of local chiefs' tyrannical hold over their tribe. When there was criticism, it often concerned Iran's economic performance and drawbacks to its development, often with an eye toward U.S. vested interests or anxieties over the fate of private American investments. Such negative perceptions slowly submerged the memory of the contributions made over the years by the U.S. government and its citizens. Iranians of the 1970s could barely recall, if at all, America's contribution to Iran's modern education, agriculture, urban improvement, and health. Ever since the 19th century, through the establishment of missionary schools for boys and girls, Americans had helped train a generation of the Iranian elite. Even after these schools were appropriated in the Reza Shah era, along with other missionary or community-run schools, they continued to produce generations of educated Iranians in such institutions as Elbers High School, originally a Presbyterian liberal arts college that expanded under the dedicated leadership of Samuel Jordan in the 1920s and 1930s, and the Nurbakhsh School for Girls, later Reza Shah Kabir, the earliest in Iran. As early as 1835, the first American Presbyterian physicians arrived in Aramiya, and later in the 19th century, American hospitals in Tabriz, Tehran, and elsewhere introduced new advances in the treatment of endemic maladies. The first female physician practicing in Iran in the late 19th century was an American missionary. The U.S. Point 4 program, initiated in 1949 to aid countries like Iran, also proved crucial for development projects in the early 1950s. These included new rural schools, improved agricultural and animal husbandry methods, irrigation techniques and seed improvement, rural health clinics, and urban amenities such as a water treatment master plan for Tehran and water delivery systems. In collaboration with the Iranian Water Authority, which had been active since 1942, the Point 4 program helped install Tehran's water treatment plant and complete the urban clean water distribution network, a major improvement in health and sanitation for the Iranian capital. American technical and financial support further had contributed to the construction of the Karaj Dam, later Amir Kabir, the first modern dam project undertaken in Iran. Completed in 1961, northwest of the capital, it proved a crucial water source for water-deficient Tehran. In the area of culture, perhaps no American initiative was as influential as Franklin Publication House, a conduit for the translation and publication of important works of American literature, academic texts, and inexpensive paperback publications that in due course became a model for other Iranian publishers. In the post-1953 era, Franklin Publishing House, financed by the non-profit Franklin Publications of New York, aimed to nurture a liberal cultural climate. It attracted Iranian talent, often intellectuals disillusioned with the left or unemployed because of past Tudeh and other political affinities on the left. Franklin gave them a chance to translate, edit, and produce in an environment relatively free of state intrusion scores of new titles, often in collaboration with Iranian publishers or through Franklin's own subsidiary. Among other American authors, Herman Melville, Jack London, Ernest Hemingway, and John Steinbeck were introduced to a Persian readership. Franklin also collaborated with the Iranian government to produce school textbooks and a series of supplementary textbooks for universities that used new pedagogical methods in a format superior to the authority-oriented, tedious texts that had been produced by the Ministry of Education since the early decades of the century. Also influential for cultivating a favorable picture of the United States as supporter of art and culture was the Iran-America Society and its cultural centers. First established in the 1950s in the United States as a quasi-governmental institution, and up to the eve of the 1979 revolution, the Society's cultural centers in Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz, and Mashhad offered courses in English language, maintained lending libraries, and published books and journals. They also served as forums for cultural activities, art exhibitions, film series, avant-garde plays, storytelling, musical concerts, and poetry readings by dissident poets. For many Iranian intellectuals and university students, tired of cheap entertainment and monotony of government-controlled media, the centers were refreshing venues relatively free of state surveillance. With a larger budget and better facilities, including an impressive cultural center in Tehran, the Iran-America Society successfully competed with other foreign cultural institutions active in Iran during the 1960s and 1970s. Besides the American cultural centers, the British Council, the French Institutes, the Soviet-Iranian Friendship Society, the German Goethe Institute, and the Iranian-Italian Cultural Society also served as forums for intellectual dissent, such as the left-leaning Iranian poets and writers. Ever since the creation of the U.S. Peace Corps in 1961, Iran ranked among the first countries to be enlisted for an educational mission. Between 1962 and 1976, some 1,748 male and female American volunteers served in towns and villages of Iran at all levels, ranging from village schools to universities teaching English and sciences. Many Iranians who came into contact with Peace Corps volunteers, attended their classes, or took part in other instructional activities, were impressed by the U.S. humanitarian mission and its commitment to improving the lot of many underprivileged communities in Iran and elsewhere. For volunteers, too, working with ordinary young Iranians in smaller towns and villages was a valuable experience, which many cherished and developed great attachment to it. It is likely that Iran's Literacy Corps, first established in 1963 as an important part of the Shah's White Revolution, was inspired by the positive experience with the American Peace Corps volunteers. Yet aside from the favorable ambiance created by the U.S. cultural and educational commitments, the closer U.S. association with Iranian security and military exposed ordinary Iranians to another aspect of American presence. By the mid-1970s, there were tens of thousands of Americans working in Iran, including in substantial number in the service of the government as military advisers, contractors, technicians, and skilled labor. Some were former military personnel of the post-Vietnam era who, in pursuit of handsomely paid jobs, moved to Iran. They were attracted to the country's burgeoning military industry, such as the U.S.-franchised Bell helicopter plant in Isfahan, operational by 1975. Others were employees of big corporations involved in large-scale construction, oil, communication, and technology projects. As far as the Pahlavi state was concerned, the American and European pool of expertise was a natural resource with which Iran could address the shortages in the skilled and technical labor during the boom years of the Iranian economy. A majority of these military personnel and civilians serving in Iran were employed at far higher salaries than their Iranian counterparts, who had mastered comparable skills and had similar experience. In turn, they enjoyed a standard of living higher than their Iranian counterparts. The economic disparity became a source of disgruntlement, soon to be compounded by notions of Americans' cultural insensitivities. Instances of Americans' condescending attitude toward Iranians in the workplace and in the street were amplified beyond proportion. Examples of rowdy, heavy-drinking, unrestrained young American men in particular publicized the imprudent Yankee stereotype in such traditional settings as in the city of Isfahan. Even less complimentary for average Iranians was the mere perception of the American military and security personnel as training, supplying, and monitoring the Iranian security forces and supervising the SAVAK. In a society devoid of free and diverse media, rumors and anecdotes, mostly unsubstantiated, went a long way toward confirming negative perceptions of the United States. They brought out xenophobic feelings embedded in Iran's recent history, while most Iranians were welcoming Americans and other foreign nationals with warmth and hospitality. The image of the innocent American abroad, nevertheless, was seriously compromised. Predictably, Iranians began to perceive two faces of America, almost independent of each other, a benevolent America and a superpower America. The first was the one to which Iranians dispatched their children in increasing numbers for higher education, purchased U.S.-manufactured goods such as cars and home appliances, watched Hollywood movies and other cultural productions, and admired technological and scientific advances such as the U.S. space program. The ugly America, in contrast, conspired and staged coups against legitimate governments abroad, fought hegemonic wars, and supported unpopular leaders in power through financial aid and military support. The two faces persisted even after the rhetoric of the Great Satan became part and parcel of the Islamic Revolution. Instruments of Control, SAVAK and Rastakhiz. As the Shah's international standing grew, he was exposed to greater criticism for his human rights record and repression at home. With Iran's greater wealth and power, especially after 1973, came a greater exercise of arbitrary rule and royal self-indulgence. Complacency and a disconnection from the realities of Iranian society slowly eroded the foundations of the Pahlavi order. The Shah's all-embracing royal power began to be hollowed, first and foremost because of his aversion to meaningful modes of pluralism and public participation. The memories of the pre-1953 years seemed to have convinced him, as he declared even in public, that in Iran, democracy could generate only discord and chaos. His resolve, his vision, and his people's loyalty and compliance, he insisted, were viable assets for Iran's progress toward great civilization. Such a vision, if it was to be believed, served as a potent excuse for applying all means of political control, without respect for contesting views that challenged his positivist vision and the arbitrary means of materializing it. By the middle of the 1960s, a few years after the June 1963 uprising, the Pahlavi regime had managed to dismantle nearly all semblance of independent political organization. The Second National Front was quickly demolished and its leaders detained before being allowed to return to their non-political careers. The Islamist Nahzat-e-Azadi freedom movement had no better luck. An offshoot of the Second National Front, founded in 1961, it was led by Mahdi Bazargan, 1907 to 1995, a professor of thermodynamics at Tehran University. Though it remained active for a number of years and recruited from among Islamically committed professionals, especially engineers, it was barred from any public engagement. The remnant of the Niruye Sevom, the Third Force, a small coalition of independent socialists, all but disappeared. In March 1966, Khalil Maliki, 1903-1969, a professor of chemistry and a theoretician of the independent left who presided over the party, was put on trial in a military tribunal and convicted to serve 3 years' imprisonment on preposterous charges. The regime also silenced virtually all independent voices of dissent, including the intellectual left, most of the activist clergy, and university students. Accommodating Maliki and his trait of socialist thought probably was the best chance the regime would have had to stop the frustrated younger generation drifting toward the radical left. By the early 1970s, the Shah's intolerance extended even to those loyal to him, who dared to uphold even moderately diverse views to his lofty dreams. Since the 1965 ouster of Temur Bakhtiar, the powerful military governor of Tehran in the post-1953 era and the first director of the SAVAK, until 1963, who entertained his own political ambitions, the Shah seldom allowed any official with independent standing, military or civilian, to emerge on the national stage. Holding views contrary to the official narrative of the White Revolution, or benign criticism of the state's economic policies and development plans, was subject to censorship. More than the Shah's actual distaste for genuine criticism was fear of the consequences, which helped nurture a climate of mediocrity and distrust. Shows of subservience were routinely staged to convince the public of the Shah's unquestionable power. Yet beneath the tedium of monolithic technocracy and sycophantic praise was a reservoir of cynicism that could slip through only in private conversations and political jokes in intimate circles. With the SAVAK under the Shah's direct control, and headed since 1965 by his loyal henchman, General Nematollah Nasiri, a man of little education or political wit, what was meant to be the government's security and intelligence apparatus for the most part became a vast network of control and coercion, arrests and torture, spying on all critics of the regime or presumed suspects, excessive surveillance and secret files. Far more than its actual capabilities, not to mention its official mission, SAVAK operated on perceptions of terror, of the ability to infiltrate dissident circles, and of horrifying interrogation methods and torture cells. Presenting a public face, Parviz Sabeti, known as the security official, Magam-e Amniati, SAVAK aimed to win over the Iranian public with a demonstration of its agility and intelligence skills. At stake was a proud demonstration of success in a covert war against the remnant of the Tudeh and followers of the recently emerged young Marxists and Islamist organizations, or indeed any other dissident. The television broadcasts in the late 1960s and early 1970s, mocked by the public as the SAVAK show, only added to the rampant cynicism and fear of the organization's long arm of intrusion and terror. Contrary to Nasiri's image of a rough-and-ready general insensitive to realities of the Iranian society, Sabeti, the deputy director for intelligence, wished to portray himself as a reforming professional. Even if this were the case, a dubious proposition, SAVAK's image hardly ever softened. By the mid-1970s, SAVAK had a staff of 5,000 and a budget of $100 million, and it was regarded as among the most efficient organizations in the country. Its staff consisted of aged army officers, civilians with a blind sense of obedience, and a large number of field officers, intelligence specialists, and interrogators, in most cases a euphemism for torturers. The organization also maintained an extensive network of informants, moles, and minders in all ministries, government organizations, universities, radio and television organizations, presses and publications, large to mid-sized factories and businesses, labor and guild organizations, among the clergy, in intellectual gatherings, in the bazaar, and in all other public and private institutions and workplaces of any significance. SAVAK informers had infiltrated guerrilla organizations and clandestine political events, mosques and religious gatherings, Iranian delegations abroad, dissident student organizations in Europe and the United States, and foreign embassies in Iran and Iranian embassies abroad. With ties to and regular arrangements for exchanges of intelligence with the CIA and other American intelligence agencies, the British MI5 and the Israeli Mossad, SAVAK appeared well-equipped, well-informed, and fully in charge. Having been barred by the Shah from foreign intelligence gathering, it primarily focused on domestic security rather than international espionage. Instilling awe even among the top echelons of the Pahlavi state, it vetted government appointments, even relatively minor posts, and kept extensive files going back to the pre-war era, not only on dissidents and those critical of the state, including former Tudeh supporters, liberal nationalists, clergy, religious activists, and intellectuals, but also on all those who had repented and returned to the Pahlavi fold. The organization used its information and interrogative resources, as well as its reputation for efficiency and brutality, to leverage its control over the society and the state. Savak, nevertheless, suffered from disastrous flaws. Following directives of its master, it was suspicious of any initiative independent of the Shah, and it was an agency devoted to silencing not only Marxist guerrillas and other activists on the left, but anyone who publicly criticized government policies and the regime's corruption and failures, or the conduct of the Shah and royal family. It did so more through an impression of omnipresence than interrogation and detention. Moreover, even those who were considered the brains behind Savak suffered from myopia and misperceptions. Savak was as paranoid as the Shah and his top statesmen, subscribing to conspiratorial theories involving imagined foreign hands, superpowers, and former superpowers in Iran's domestic troubles, ranging from guerrilla movements to provisions shortages and economic gridlock. Even among ministers and top civil servants, Savak suspected foreign moles and sympathizers, oddly enough, more British and American than Soviet. The Savak shared this paranoid perspective with the Shah and most members of the Pahlavi elite. Bureaucratic and inflexible, Savak proved utterly incapable of detecting the root causes of radical challenges and growing popular discontent. It also proved inept in forecasting the 1979 revolution, and when it arrived, its ability to handle it was miserably paralyzed. For its entire history, Savak was more in the business of coercion and abuse than inquiry and analysis. In many respects, it lived and died by the failings of its royal master. The dismantling of even moderate voices of dissent was followed by a reckless attempt to manufacture an all-embracing political party. By the mid-1970s, the semblance of a two-party scheme was no longer viable even by the Shah. In 1964, the Iran Noveen Party, headed by a younger generation of mostly upper-class technocrats under Hassan Ali Mansour, and after his assassination under Amir Abbas Hovedar, tried to steer a moderately independent course, but was quickly persuaded to comply with royal wishes. Despite maintaining a parliamentary caucus and occasionally engaging in heated discord with the Mardum Party, both parties seldom were seen as anything but incredulous outfits designed to lend the image of constitutionality to the royal autocracy. Added to the failure of the two-party model, the country's mounting problems of inefficiency, nepotism, and corruption persuaded the Shah to opt for a one-party political model, and with a hasty arbitrariness reminiscent of Nasser ad-Din Shah and his frequent government restructuring. There was no public debate and few devised plans. Motivated by the Soviet and Chinese models, perhaps, or the Ba'ath Party in neighbouring Iraq, the royal decision in March 1975 to launch the Rastakhiz Party was a turning point in the Shah's desire to engage his people at a deeper level. Inherently autocratic, the party was hailed by the regime's propaganda machine as the magical solution to political bickering, going beyond the politics of the elite, and a way to mobilize ordinary Iranians over common goals of the revolution of the Shah and the people. As a monopoly over the political process, Rastakhiz aimed, ominously, to include all Iranians among its membership. To the extent that any program was articulated for the new party, it was to encourage popular participation in the affairs of their community and their workplace. Political engagement, however, was carefully avoided, and everyone, leaders and the rank and file, understood from the outset that serious political discourse was not in the agenda. Party participation aimed to generate new dynamics to combat deficiencies and economic shortfalls, and to open new channels for social and economic development. Anyone who refused to join the party, declared the Shah in a remarkably blunt statement, evidently was not a patriot, and might as well resign his or her citizenship and leave the country for permanent exile. The mandatory party membership was a prelude to harsher measures to come: overhaul of the social order, education, labour relations, bureaucracy, and economy. Yet compromises quickly unmade the Rastakhiz party's lofty goals. In a fashion befitting any autocratic regime, incapable of reforming itself, the two wings of the party, the progressive and constructive liberal, were led by two of the most faithful technocrats of the regime. They were powerful ministers in Hovedar's government, and long had enjoyed regime favours and all the privileges of the Pahlavi elite. Despite their predictable professional credentials, as it turned out, they were devoid of any vision or programme, much less a mission. It soon became clear that, so far as the hierarchy of power was concerned, it was business as usual. The Shah and his advisers, if the best of intentions were to be attributed to them, were naive to believe that most Iranians, teachers, workers, villagers, bazaar merchants, students, low- and middle-ranking civil servants, and homemakers, not to mention intellectuals and sceptics, would genuinely believe in such lacklustre gimmickry. The lofty slogans routinely spewed from state-controlled media and the vast financial resources at the party's disposal resulted in superficial, extensive grassroots mobilization in the villages, factories, neighborhoods, schools, and government offices, and for a moment created some stir. The Rastakhiz solution to glaring lack of democratic process, however, soon began to unravel. Even the most ardent supporters of the regime quickly turned into skeptics. By 1977, only 2 years after it was first launched, the party's performance appeared dismal even to the Shah, who tried to reshuffle the top leadership so as to avoid a political fiasco. The new party leaders, also picked from the small reserves of Pahlavi male elite, were no more imaginative or effective in the task of building a reliable popular base while Iranian society was fast rushing toward full-scale revolution. A year later, the last-ditch effort to reinvent Rastakhiz also failed, even as the Shah tried, under public pressure, to liberalize the party. Under the weight of popular protests, the Rastakhiz party was the first of the Pahlavi enterprises to crumble. Unrelenting in adulation for the Shah and lacking a political spine, it never offered a forum for critically examining the many urgent defects of the regime, let alone providing a genuine vehicle for public participation. Inflation and price control. Coinciding with the years of Rastakhiz party, and as part of its populist plan of action, the government started a campaign to stabilize prices, an initiative to harness raging inflation. It intended to remedy the problem primarily by fixing consumer prices at the retail level, a measure resembling the Persian proverbial punishment of the neighborhood backers for the rising wheat prices. The campaign resulted in a wave of business closures, massive penalties, state takeover of private industries, and detention of industrialists and wholesalers for alleged hoarding and price hiking. The high inflation, by some accounts nearly 25% annually by the late 1970s, was triggered mainly by the undue injection of oil income into the Iranian economy. With all the new revenue entering the economy, the government too was persuaded to go on a shopping spree of unprecedented scale. New development projects, massive imports, military hardware, high-level services, and a whole range of investments in cities. Rapid growth of the construction industry and a subsequent shortage of skilled and unskilled labour force would soon follow. Symptoms such as these were to be expected in most, if not all, developing economies. Less common, however, and probably avoidable, were the remedies adopted by the Pahlavi state. Undermining domestic markets, the newly earned revenue favoured importers but worked against other sectors of the economy, especially manufacturers and their suppliers. Rising prices, moreover, concerned the regime because they exposed weaknesses in planning and policy making, where the public had little say in the direction of the market or in economic decision making. To remedy the situation, however artificially, the state effectively retaliated against the industrial and retail sectors, the backbone of its consumer economy. Some manufacturers were forced to lower quality to stay within price ranges, while others lowered volume, causing shortages of vital consumer goods and agricultural products, hence creating new incentives for foreign imports and hoarding. With the growth of the population and the rise in the standard of living, demand for food and consumer goods noticeably went up. As early as the mid-1960s, because of urban migration, an unintended consequence of the land reform, Iran's agricultural output could not keep up with growing demand. Beginning in the early 1970s, Iran, having long relied on its own domestic production, became a net food importer, bringing in products ranging from meat from New Zealand and Australia to grains, sugar, and dairy products from Europe, Russia, Canada, and the United States. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi era, moreover, the Iranian population had improved in every generation, physically, hygienically, and medically, from the frail, malnourished, and diseased population at the turn of the 20th century, visible in many photographs of the period, to a relatively healthy, sanitary, and better nourished people in the last quarter of the century. The need for greater quantities and greater varieties of food, home appliances, electronics, and cars, thus was bound to become a burden for a government anxious to keep its population economically content. Particularly striking were shortages in utilities, especially electricity, and agricultural produce, an embarrassment to the state's projected image of power and prosperity. The hollow promises smacked of a shortage of essentials, from onions, potatoes, and rice to propane gas. These were compounded by arbitrary restrictions on urban zoning and a construction moratorium. Traffic congestion in Tehran and other provincial centres, compounded by air pollution, only added to discontent among a public not yet fully accustomed to economic bottlenecks. The state's anti-corruption campaigns, periodically making the headlines, had limited effect. Embezzlement, nepotism, and illicit deals were not rare. The state had neither the serious desire to stop nor the means of stopping the corrupt practices in which many of its own ministers, high officials, and members of the royal family had a stake. In October 1975, a series of corruption trials put behind bars a few generals and high-ranking officials for taking illicit commissions for the purchase of arms abroad, commissions that seemingly had been approved, at least in the eyes of ordinary people, by the Shah and the government. In February 1976, another scandal concerning the $28 million purchase of F-14 fighter jets from the US corporation Grumman also resulted in dismissals and imprisonments. A purchase of $40 million of sugar on the open market, also in 1976, resulted in the conviction and imprisonment of officials. In their trials, the defendants argued that in such deals they were aided by high officials whose names and positions they could not reveal. Yet, in the booming economy of the 1970s, the temptations to make a quick fortune were too great and the restraints too relaxed to allow any widespread anti-corruption campaign to take root. Urban guerrillas and the lure of armed struggle. In the absence of viable alternatives to secular dissent, and with Pahlavi absolutism firmly in place, the rise of guerrilla movements in Iran in the late 1960s appeared to many younger dissidents an alluring alternative. With party politics long dismantled, except for the Sham Rastakhiz party, the liberal nationalist veterans and moderate socialists were silenced or voluntarily went into exile. With them went the once appealing call to restore the constitutional monarchy. In the absence of the Tudeh party, which had once been a grassroots political organization, the hardline alternatives were narrowed down to two: Islamic militants, who advanced a double message of anti-Pahlavi and anti-secular opposition, and guerrilla armed struggle to overthrow the Pahlavi regime. While the former essentially appealed to the mosque-going lower middle classes in the bazaar and poorer neighbourhoods, the latter recruited from the younger middle classes, mostly university students. Marxist insurgency appealed to children of families with Tudeh or other leftist tendencies. Islamic ideology, such as that of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, however, attracted the children of pious families. Their numbers were small, but their impact tangible. Predictably, guerrilla struggle in Iran came about in the 1960s when Marxist-inspired movements abounded around the world. The radical left everywhere fell captive to the aura of such revolutionaries as Fidel Castro and his comrades in arms in the 1959 Cuban Revolution. As elsewhere, in Iran too, the bearded image of the handsome and charismatic Che Guevara before being commercialized on posters and T-shirts, greatly appealed to the left. In the Vietnam War years, the Viet Cong's unyielding resistance against the Americans also struck chords of sympathy among the Iranians. These replaced the steely image of the mustachioed Comrade Stalin, who had long fascinated Tudeh members and sympathizers. The equally steely image of Mao Zedong survived in the Iranian revolutionary pantheon even after the crimes of the Cultural Revolution became better known. Moreover, the left was moved by the intensity of the Palestinian struggle and its revolutionary voice during the heydays of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It was seen by many as the closest and the most pertinent cause in the face of Pahlavi rapprochement with Israel. The rise of the new European left, manifest in the 1968 Paris uprising, was another source of inspiration. The Algerian independence movement also served as a shining example. The Iranian guerrilla organizations viewed themselves as one such vanguard in a grand struggle against Western hegemony and its agents, and the Shah, in their eyes, was a prime candidate. As with most movements of the time, the Iranian guerrillas were disillusioned with the Soviet Union and its modified Stalinist ideology under Brezhnev and his colleagues. The crushing of the Prague Spring and the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia in August 1968 came as a shock to the left and its intellectual affiliates. In addition to Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, and Che Guevara, all praised for their armed struggles, and Patrice Lumumba for being a martyr of African struggle, there were Iranian heroes. They ranged from the 6th-century Persian prophet Mazdak, the founder of probably the earliest communist-style movements in world history, to Mirza Kuchach Khan. The likes of Taghi Arani and Khosra Ruzbeh were held in awe. Mossadegh, however, held an ambivalent place in their ideological landscape, as did socialist intellectuals such as Khalil Maliki. As a liberal nationalist coming from an aristocratic background, Mossadegh was admired for his anti-imperialist stance, but was also seen as a transitory figure whose struggle was bound to lead to the revolution of the masses. Over the years, the movement itself generated its own martyrs and upheld them as role models for the new recruits. That there were too many of them fallen in clashes with security forces added to the movement's appeal. The ideology of the Iranian left brought together classic Marxism-Leninism, often from a Maoist perspective, with nationalist traits inspired by Latin American movements. To a lesser extent, the experience of the Iranian left since the Constitutional Revolution informed the new radical trends. Though the left distrusted the Tudeh as subservient to the Soviet Union and deluded by Stalinist ideology in its strict application of class struggle, it was not free of Stalinist legacy. Nor did it budge from the Tudeh ideal of dismantling the Pahlavi bourgeoisie comprador, seen as an agent of Western capitalism, and creating a dictatorship of the proletariat. Armed struggle, spearheaded by the urban guerrillas, it was believed, was soon to be backed by the masses, the working classes, the urban poor, and the rural population. The greatest threat, it was agreed, was US hegemony and the US support for police states, which the militants contended could not have survived without active American backing. Almost exclusively made up of young men and women in their 20s and early 30s, the clandestine guerrilla organization of the Fadayan-e Khalq, Sazman-e Cheriki-e Fadayan-e Khalq, literally, the organization of the devotees who sacrifice themselves for the people, was founded in 1966 through a merger of several smaller radical Marxist groups. One of its influential affiliates, Bijan Jazani, 1937-1975, a doctoral candidate in philosophy at Tehran University and a theoretician of the movement, came from a family of Tudeh activists. While Bijan was a young boy, his father, a junior army officer, had joined the Azerbaijan Democrats and in 1946 defected to the Soviet Union. Bijan himself was a dissident in Tudeh circles and an affiliate of the Second National Front. Though repeatedly detained and imprisoned by the Savak, he managed to disseminate his revolutionary message in and out of prison, even after 1969, when he and a number of his cohorts received long prison terms from military tribunals on common charges of membership in an illegal Marxist organization and conspiracy to overthrow the Pahlavi regime. His tragic end, along with 8 other cohorts, added to his aura as a martyr for the cause of the left. They were cold-bloodedly executed in secret in the vicinity of their Wien prison in April 1975, apparently in reprisal for the upsurge of guerrilla warfare and a wave of assassination of SAVAK agents. Executions were masked as the outcome of an escape attempt. Jazani's pamphleteering was not devoid of a historical perspective. It was primarily informed by class analysis, deeply critical of US hegemony and Pahlavi dictatorship. Yet in comparison with his comrades, he suffered less the Fadayan's typical naivete and their almost messianic call to spearhead an impending socialist revolution. He was critical of the Tudeh past, its subservice to the Soviets, and its rebuff of Mossadegh. Having returned after a lapse to Tehran University, he wrote a dissertation supervised by Gholam Hossein Sadighi on the forces and objectives of the constitutional revolution. Familiarity with the Iranian constitutional struggle and the complexity of Iranian historical experience set him apart from the hotheads who came to dominate the organization. Over the years, however, Jazani's intellectual journey did not lead him to a liberal socialist perspective, but rather to a Maoist, rural, revolutionary model in Iran in place of the Bolshevik model. Most of the Fadayan envisioned themselves as forerunners of a revolutionary process that would eventually awaken the peoples, Khalkha, of Iran and erect a utopian society of liberated workers and peasants. The movement, nevertheless, was rife with internal rivalries and ideological splits, which was as effective as SAVAK in rendering the movement dysfunctional. Their advocacy of autonomy for Iran's ethnicities, mostly in the realm of imagination, was theoretically luring, but politically dangerous, giving an ominous green light to Kurdish, Azerbaijani, Turkmen, Arab, and other dormant secession tendencies. There was a sincere desire to recognize Iran's ethnic patchwork of diverse cultural identities, and the left invariably paid homage to such diversity. Yet it was oblivious, or ideologically blind, to the hazards that threatened Iran's integrity in the 1920s and then again in the 1940s. Despite its blind spots, the Fedayan movement can be credited with sensing the rise of social discontent in Iran of the 1960s, even though its prescribed class struggle proved misplaced, at least according to its definition of class. The Fadayan-e Khalk shared its indoctrination with the Mujahideen-e Khalk, People's Crusaders, guerrilla organization that emerged in the same time period. Founded in 1965, it was a movement with firmer grassroots, bridging Marxism and political Islam. Rooted in Islamic trends of the post-war era, and in due course the revolutionary romanticism of Ali Shariati and solidarity with the Third World then in vogue, the Mujahideen movement was a rough Islamic equivalent of Latin American liberation theology, but with an appetite for armed warfare. Gleaning selectively from the Quranic verses, mostly prescribing violence and warning of vengeance, and investing in politicized Shi'i paradigms of sacrifice and martyrdom, the Mujahideen sought in Islam more than devotional acts or a sense of community. They criticized, for the same reason, the passive compliance of most members of the clerical class and their conservative readings of Islamic values. Masses were to be liberated through the exemplar of Shi'i Imam Ali and his son Imam Hussein to create a classless society, not by the forces of historical materialism, but by means of egalitarian Islam and collective sacrifice on the model of Karbala. The Mujahideen's culture of armed struggle resembled that of the Marxist Fadayan, but wrapped in a garb of Islamic symbolism. It was no surprise, then, that some of the Mujahideen, while in the Shah's prison, could dispose of their diluted Islamic Marxism in favor of a Marxist offshoot that rivaled both Fadayin and the Mujahideen. Almost religiously puritanical, later it was renamed Pekar, warfare, on the eve of the 1979 revolution, appealing to younger recruits who joined its ranks in droves. Even more than other Marxist movements, Pekar members were the target of street clashes as well as arrest and execution by the Islamic Republic's newly organized Revolutionary Guards. In more than one way, the guerrilla movements in the late 1960s and 1970s left their mark on Iran's radical politics. In the decade and a half before the 1979 revolution, most immediate was their unsettling effect on the public space, tarnishing the otherwise ultra-confident Pahlavi image at the height of its seemingly imperturbable power. Street clashes with Savak and the security forces, which resulted in the death of legendary guerrilla leaders like Hamid Ashraf, 1946 to 1976, attacks on gendarmerie outposts, reports in the press with pictures of men and women killed or captured, television appearances whereby the security authority boasted about Savak's successes in eliminating the saboteurs, Kharab Karan, and even television broadcasts of the military courts sentencing young guerrilla detainees to long-term imprisonment or execution, all had a disquieting impact on the Iranian public. The unintended consequence of the state's publicity, along with refuting the damning reports of Amnesty International and other human rights organizations that highlighted oppression and torture in Iran, marred, if not entirely discredited, the state's image of success and grandeur that it was keen to display internationally. The most striking at the outset of the guerrilla armed struggle was the Siyakal episode. In February 1971, 12 members of Fedayan, who intended to ignite an uprising in Siyakal, a scenic rural town deep in the forest of Gilan province, 220 miles north of Tehran, attacked a gendarmerie outpost to release one of their comrades. After a fatal exchange of fire, several were killed and 10 captured, and subsequently tried and executed in March of that year. The botched incident proved the naivete of the Fedayan and its wishful reliance on the support of villagers, which never materialized. The state's attempt to amplify Siyakal beyond what it was, even after eliminating the armed guerrillas, also revealed the depth of the regime's anxiety. The incident acquired an iconic place in the narrative of the left, and a few allusions in songs and films celebrated the incident as a heroic challenge to the power of the state. Intensified clashes with the security forces after 1971, coinciding with the celebration of 2,500 years of the Iranian monarchy, though never remotely reaching the level of urban warfare, resulted in several assassinations of military prosecutors, police chiefs, Savak agents, and state officials, and at least 4 instances of assassinations of American military advisers to the Iranian armed forces between 1972 and 1976. It was the Mujahideen who mostly carried out these attacks. At the height of the guerrilla movement came the arrest and trial of the Fedayan activist and poet Khosrow Golesorhi, 1944-1974, who was sentenced in a public trial in the military court in January 1974 and executed along with his cohorts. Charged with subversion to overthrow the Pahlavi regime, he was seen as a martyr of the left for his valiant defense. Even for those who did not sympathize with his ideology, Golesorhi's execution epitomized all that was wrong with the Pahlavi regime. Even though the revolutionary left, whether Marxist or Marxist-Islamic, was more a symptom than an agent of instantaneous change, their struggle anticipated the mass appeal of the Islamic Revolution that arrived in their wake shortly afterward. By 1978, the era of urban guerrilla struggle was almost at its end. Yet a number of men and women who lost their lives in bloody street clashes or in safe houses, or who died in front of firing squads, were harbingers of still more ominous times awaiting these guerrilla organizations. According to one estimate, in the 8 years between 1970 and 1978, Fedayan-e Halk lost the total of 198 of their fighters, of whom 169 were men and 29 women. The 15% rate for woman participation was remarkable, since very rarely did women take an active part in earlier resistance movements in Iran. By contrast, the number of Mujahideen casualties between 1971 and 1976 was no more than 15, of which only one was a woman. The significant discrepancy may well be attributed to the strength of the Marxist ideology as opposed to Islamic Marxism. Only during and after the Islamic Revolution, and coinciding with the ascendancy of radical Islamic rhetoric, greater appeal for Islamic Marxism shifted the balance in favor of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. In the first decade after the revolution, both organizations suffered horrendous losses, far higher than in pre-revolutionary years.